Welcome to Left, Right, and Unwanted, the podcast where three people from across the political spectrum discuss ideas and politics. I'm Lauren, and I'm the left.
I'm Morgan, and I'm the right.
I'm Luke, and I'm the unwanted.
Today, we are without the services of Morgan, who has decided to place her family above the podcast in an act of utter betrayal. Today, we are going to be discussing the first chapter of the book, The Problem of Political Authority by Michael Humer. Michael Humer is a philosopher at the University of Colorado Boulder. His work is mainly in the realm of political theory, and he is, as we will get into later, a moral intuitionist. Lauren, before you read this book, how familiar were you with various anarchist arguments?
Little to none. I guess aside from last week's episode, that was an area of interest of the author of last week's article, but he didn't really get into any theory. So this was probably my first exposition to any anarchist theory.
If you had to define anarchism, how would you define it?
Using his own words, I'd like to finish the book before I commit to a definition. But it's defined as questioning the presupposition that the government has set. Like, not how to use it, but should it exist?
The definition you just gave is probably what I would consider more of a thin definition. There are some anarchists, particularly on the left, who would associate not only a belief in the illegitimacy of the state, which is what I would consider a thin position, but there are those on the left who would also attach anti-capitalism and anti-hierarchy requirements to be an anarchist. There's several different schools of thought out there, but Michael Humer, who is the author today, identifies as an anarcho-capitalist, which is typically viewed as a right-wing anarchist, as opposed to an anarcho-communist or anarcho-syndicalist, typically on the left, or an anarcho-mutualist, who tend to be more moderate. The first part of chapter one is entitled A Political Parable. And Michael Humer starts the book off with a short story about how you live in a small village. There's a crime problem with some vandals roaming around. You take guns. You go looking for the vandals. You'll catch one, take him back to your house at gunpoint, and lock him in the basement. And you keep them there for a few years to teach them a lesson. And then after that, you go around to your neighbors and say, hey, look what all these things I've been doing. Because I'm helping out the neighborhood, you need to pay me. Here's your bill. And they have no desire to pay you, so you threaten them and say, look, unless you pay me, you're going to go in my basement right next to the vandals. His takeaway from this parable is, we would not view your actions as favorable. We would view you as a kidnapper and as a thief. But, in essence, everything you're doing is the same thing that governments do. In modern society, we typically view government agents as considered ethically permitted to do things that no non-governmental person or organization may do. And individuals are thought to have obligations to their governments that they would owe toward no non-governmental person or organization. Our ethical judgments are differentiating between government and non-government actions. Why is this the case? That is what he has identified as the problem of political authority.
I agreed with how the actor in the parable would be perceived. Even imagining that on a smaller scale, just any action taken to correct crime on your own and then demand payment, I don't think would be met very well by others at all.
I agree that there's probably few people who would say that your actions in the scenario were acceptable. This idea of government agents can do things that people cannot is pretty ingrained into our thinking. We see this in television shows where cops can do things like commandeer cars, actions like that, which we would view as crimes by others. In section 1.2, Michael Humer gets into what is it that differentiates your actions from the actions of government agents. And he says there's two different explanations. The first explanation is, even though it looks like you're doing the same thing as what a government agent does, they're actually different things. For instance, maybe you aren't giving the vandals jury trials where the government does. So that's one explanation, is you're doing different things. The other explanation is that the two agents are different. Even though you are doing the same things as a government agent, who is doing it makes all the difference. And that idea that that the government agents are different from you and have more privileges than you is the concept of political authority, which consists of political legitimacy, which is the right on the part of the government to make certain sort of laws and enforce them, and political obligation, which is the mirror of that, which is the obligation on the part of the citizens to obey, even when you wouldn't be obligated to obey similar commands from someone who is not the government.
What about circumstances where it's not really a question of obedience, but creating rules that are just naturally followed? We have a lot of moral rules that the average citizen takes for granted. Most people I know would never even come close to breaking a law about murdering others. Like, it's something that is a law, but I think it already exists in our consciousness. I guess what I'm getting at is it is created through legitimacy. But even today, if you were to ask people to sit around and, hey, invent a society, think of a bunch of laws for people to follow, I don't think that'd be one that people would view as an obligation. So is there a difference if you are following it independent of an obligation to a higher authority?
He does get into, there are things we are obligated to do whether the law commands them or not. So there are certain pre-existing moral obligations incumbent on everyone. You can't murder. And so we have a duty to obey that, but that's not a rule created by the government. He talks about we are obligated to do things precisely because the law commands them, and we would not be obligated to do those things if they were not legally required. For instance, let's say the government raises the income tax rate on an individual from 10 to 20%. Mm-hmm. No one would say that, absent any law, an individual is required to give exactly 20% of their in pre-tax income to the government. But a lot of people would say, because the government has raised the effective tax rate, now that person is required to give 20%. And so that is something that the state has the ability to enforce, and we as citizens have the obligation to obey. He's recognizing a difference between pre-existing duties and ones created by the state, and he's focusing on duties created by the state.
The idea that you, whether you disagree or agree, it's your obligation to follow the law.
That is what political authority means to him. The state can make rules that are not pre-existing moral obligations, and by the fact that the state has created these new rules, they are now moral obligations on the citizens.
I guess off the top of my head, I can't think of specific instances where I see one existing without the other. But I also wonder if that's because a lot of the morality we're taught is shaped by the desire to conform to laws we have in place. There's citizenship standards you're taught when you're a kid. There's different things in place that I think are both influenced by and then also shape our morality. Maybe the fact that we don't see them existing independently is because we live in a system where they're tied together already.
If I give 20% of my income to the local mafia don because he's going to put concrete on my feet and drop me in the river if I don't, everyone would agree what the mafia don is doing is morally wrong. If, on the other hand, I give the state 20% of my income, although it's actually much more than that, but if I give the state 20% of my income because I'm afraid they're going to lock me in a cage for 10 years, not everyone views that as something that's wrong. So clearly they're differentiating in their mind between the mafia don and the state. And that differentiation is part of this idea of political authority.
I think some people do make the differentiation. I also think some people do it without thinking. I don't disagree. I think for some people it really, and I think even for me, probably it is a distinction. There's things that I do because it's the law, and I probably am okay with it because I've always done it. But I'm not sure everyone actually puts thoughts into the why behind it. And I think some people just, it's reactionary.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of people out there who don't think about why the government is entitled to do these things and don't really think about it. But everyone at the back of their minds, I think, can understand that, oh, the cop can speed, but the citizen cannot. There's a funny tweet I read once. So it was like, I remember when I was little and I used to think the cops could just break the law all the time. And then I got older and found out that wasn't true. And then I got even older and found out it actually was true. One thing that humor gets into is that this perceived authority to create obligations that people then are obligated to follow doesn't have to be unconditional or absolute. So you could hold, for instance, that the state's authority is contingent on respecting basic human rights and allowing citizens participation, thus tyrannical governments lack authority, but democracies have authority. You can also hold that there are limits to what the government can command. So for instance, a government can command a person to give them 20% of their income, but it can't command them to give them 95% of their income, or can't command them to commit murder. This political authority doesn't have to be absolute, but in order for a state to be able to force someone to give them 20% of their income, there still has to be some amount of political authority. And despite any limitations placed on it, the authority is still a very impressive moral property. So it can explain, for instance, why some people can throw people in cages and other people cannot, why some people can extort from others and some people cannot. So this phenomenon is something that we have to reckon with. In section 1.3, he gets into an earlier distinction he made between why are the behaviors between what the government does and what we did in the parable different. And the first option he gave was, well, maybe we're doing different things. The second option he gave was the government has this political authority. And in this section, he goes back to his first offered explanation and explains why he doesn't think it's the case. You are actually doing the exact same thing as the government, and it's a political authority that provides the explanation. So for instance, even if you gave jury trials, most people would view it as wrong, especially if you went out to the community and told your neighbor, hey, you have to show up for this trial, and if you don't, guess what? You're going to get put in my cage, as we have with compulsory jury service. Or, you know, some people might say, well, government agents arrest people only for explicitly published laws, which isn't the case, but we'll pretend that it is. And he says, well, people still wouldn't think what you were doing in the parable was okay if you posted everything that you were going to put people in your basement for on a big board outside your house. Then finally, he gets into democracy, and he says that they might say that, well, the community didn't choose you to do this, whereas communities choose governments to do these things in other places. And what he says is, this is an appeal to an authority. It's not an appeal to a difference in actions. So really, these actions are the same, and in order to understand why you can't put people in your basement for vandalism, but the government can put people in cages for vandalism, is about political authority. So we have to account for why governments have political authority.
I guess at face value, that would be my first argument against this, is that the number one problem is nobody asked you to do this, and you appointed yourself in charge of the community. Whereas living in our society, you have structures that handle this already. So I guess that was the part I would want to see his rebuttal for. I'm interested in that.
I think his first answer to that is, okay, if you think that the community selecting you to perform some function is what legitimizes it, then the vast majority of governments throughout history have been illegitimate because democracy is a fairly new phenomenon. And then he also has some other arguments against democracy. In section 1.4, he gets into the significance of coercion. I don't know how much you know about the modern concept of the state and, you know, where it came from. I read an article once by a guy named Quentin Skinner about some of its origins.
I think I've read it.
Oh, really?
Maybe. Yeah. I think I actually talked about it with someone the other day. I couldn't tell you who, though.
Doesn't sound very memorable, whoever it was. The commonly accepted definition of the state is it's an entity that has the monopoly on legitimate violence. So in section 1.4, he really gets into what that means, that violence, a coercion. So he defines coercion. He uses it as a defined term in this book, and he uses it to denote the use of or threat to use physical force against another person. So he doesn't include coercion in the sense that, oh, I'll leak a damaging rumor about you, or I'll pay you or not pay you to do something. He's really talking just about physical force. And he discusses how government is inherently a coercive institution. When the state makes a law, the law carries with it a punishment to be imposed on violators. Nearly all laws have physical violence attached to them, even if it's not immediately apparent at the outset. So for instance, running through a red light, you'll get a ticket. But what happens if you don't pay the ticket? Maybe they'll revoke your driver's license. And then what happens if you keep driving without your driver's license? Well, then they'll come to your house. And eventually, at the end of the chain, no matter how long it is, for murder, it's a much shorter chain. For not registering your vehicle, it's a much longer chain. But at the end of the chain, it always comes down to violence. this is an insight that I think a lot of people, if you explain it to them, they understand, but it's not at the forefront of everyone's mind that every law involves violence against citizens. You hear people all the time, oh, there ought to be a law for this, there ought to be a law for that. And I just think you do realize that every time you say that, you're talking about, at the end of the day, you're okay with people with guns going after that person for not doing whatever it is you want them to do or for doing whatever it is that you don't want them to do. And I think that's something that's missed in a lot of our discussions about laws. So for instance, in Ferguson, which was where Michael Brown was shot, and there was a lot of antipathy toward the police, a big issue was the town had basically lost its tax base. And so they were funding the town through ticketing mostly black people who were the remaining residents in the town for every single little thing they could, because that's how they paid for everything, because there was no tax base. And people understood on the left, they would make this argument that every single encounter with the police could potentially end in the death of someone. And then I hear those same people arguing for a nationwide mask mandate when COVID-19 comes out. I very rarely heard those people, who are often the same people, understand that you are creating tons and tons of interactions with police now. That's just not a fact that I hear acknowledged, is that every single thing you want to make illegal, you want to put a ban on this, are you okay with someone potentially dying from this?
That is something I have actually thought about a lot this whole year. And it started when Nick, and going to the DMV, that's something he likes to do. And he told me a couple months ago, well, like, oh, no one's getting stopped right now for any minor vehicle registration issues because they don't want to interact with the public, or it puts an unnecessary risk on people to stop someone for expired plates or for every little thing. I really have been thinking about it, because I think in the past, before this year, I would consider myself guilty of at least one saying like, oh, well, that should be against the law, or, oh, we need to regulate this. I know I've said it before, but with a more, I don't want to say real, but visible threat like disease, it started to make me think twice, like, okay, so if I get stopped for this, or if I don't register my car, I don't renew my plates and I get stopped, it's putting my life or like my work in danger. It might hurt somebody else. And like you said, that can be generalized outside of just a communicable disease. It creates more interaction in terms of policing others' behavior. And this made me think about everything else I was thinking about, because really, I know I've said it before. I know there's been things I've spoken out on and said like, oh, we'll just make it against the law, problem solved, we're done. But if you're in a group that has traditionally poor interactions with law enforcement, more opportunity for you to interact with that agency probably are not in your best interests.
COVID really illustrated this for me in a couple ways. So I saw a lot of people talk about, and not unreasonably so, I get the argument for limiting gathering sizes. So some places, you know, said no inside church services. Some places said no more than X amount of people over to your house for Thanksgiving. Then you see the police going into a church parking lot and giving everyone who was at church a ticket, which the idea that you could, a year ago, I was like, you know, the police in Mississippi are going to be handing out tickets to people going to church. People would be like, wait, that was this conspiracy theorist. Or that video in Canada where the police broke into someone's house and literally dragged a man out for having his family over for Thanksgiving. I mean, unless you're a pacifist, there are things that you are okay with people using force to stop. So murder, rape, theft. You know, I'm okay if someone's about to rape someone else and someone going by sees it and tackles the guy. You know, like, I'm fine with that. Very few people wouldn't be. But you have to broaden that out and say, okay, but am I okay with this person didn't get a permit before they put a chicken coop on their yard? Am I okay with violence being used against that person for that now? I mean, there's definitely a scale of, yes, I'm okay with the police going in with guns drawn to stop Buffalo Bill from skinning a girl alive, but this person just didn't get a permit before they built a chicken coop. And so that's just something that's in the back of my mind whenever I see laws.
It makes me think about the protests that took place this past summer and how quickly in so many locations what was often meant to be a peaceful demonstration escalated because of police presence. And if you look at who had weapons and who didn't, or how people acquired certain weapons they had. Like if you're handed a weapon by the government and said, hey, stop the protest, I think it increases the likelihood for the violence side that humor's discussing to come into play. Because this I really do agree with, and I didn't realize I agreed with it until I read it, but it's almost like a what if game. Like violence may not be inherent for a single infraction or something minor, but if you keep saying no, if you keep saying, well, what are you going to do now? Eventually, you're going to reach the end of the line. I think we saw that reached more quickly during the protests. Just something that really shouldn't have been quite as violent as it was so quickly exacerbated.
These simple things can escalate into violence so quickly. And that's what he's talking about when he's talking about how the legal system is founded on intentional harmful coercion. That's what it's there for. Now, maybe you think it's justified, especially in some cases. I think it absolutely is. I mean, intentional harmful coercion to keep people from murdering is something I'm fine with living in a society where that's present. But what about intentional harmful coercion against someone who doesn't want to give the government 20% of their income? How do we justify that? And he gets into this himself about how some justifications for harmful coercions exist, and other reasons for coercion are clearly inadequate. If you have a friend who's eating too many potato chips, you can try to convince him to stop, but if he won't listen, you don't get to force him to stop. The biggest example of the government using coercive force is war. And so he talks about how maybe you think a neighboring town is building weapons, and so you go over there to the neighbor town, you depose the mayor, you blow up some buildings, and kill some innocent people, and you just label them as collateral damage. Well, if you behave that way, people would call you a terrorist and a murderer, and people would want you to be executed or put in prison. But when the government does it, we just call it war.
Well, you could even look at the draft. If you want to look at war as state-mandated violence that's legal and even welcome, I guess you might as well look at the draft along with it. The idea that not only can there be a war, and that's okay, but the government can put you in the war, and that's okay. And if you don't go, you're in big trouble.
They can kidnap people between the ages of 18 and, 23 or 25 or whatever it is. And yeah, I mean, I remember when Kony was so bad because he was kidnapping kids and making them fight for him. Well, I mean, the U.S. government was doing that for a long time in history. So in section 1.5, humor gets into really trying to granularize political authority. To this point, we've talked about it as sort of a vague, abstract concept, but now he's really trying to get into narrowing it down into what are the aspects of political authority. And he identifies five principles. The first is generality, so the state's authority applies to citizens generally. The second is particularity, so the state only applies to citizens and people in its territory. The third is content independence, so the state's authority is not tied to the specific content of its laws or other commands. It's not like the state can make the income tax rate 15%, but not 20%. Now, maybe you say it can't make it 90%, but it still has pretty broad latitude in between, 0 and 60 or 80 or 40 or whatever your cutoff line is. The fourth is comprehensiveness, so the state can regulate a broad range of human authority. It can make minimum wage laws, it can make, public health laws, it can make laws against drugs and, all these other kinds of things. And the fifth is supremacy, and that is within the sphere of action that the state is entitled to regulate. The state is the highest human authority, so no non-governmental agent can command the state. To illustrate this, he talks about taxation. So taxes can be imposed generally on everyone in its territory. The second is particularity. So states can tax people in their territory, but you can't tax people that aren't in your territory. Although this is actually trying to be undermined by the state of California, which has so many people leaving California, it's trying to tax people that no longer live in California. There's a wealth tax that's being proposed in California that would apply to anyone who ever lived in California, even if they, after the law is passed, move out of the state. And the third is content independence. So again, the tax rate can be set at some range. The government, it's not only legitimate if it's at an exact percentage. And no one is entitled to tax the state or to tax individuals, and that's the idea of supremacy.
I was trying to think of examples for each, and I was finding things that I felt fit, and then things I thought, well, wait, isn't this a good thing, or isn't this okay? In the tax case, I think he makes it a little more cut and dry. And he also does it with a concept that he previously defined as a purely political concept. People don't really pay taxes out of a moral obligation. If they stopped existing, many people wouldn't pay them and wouldn't question it. So I thought it was a smart way to illustrate it because it made it make a little more sense to me.
I'm trying to think of something similar to tax that doesn't have sort of a pre-existing moral obligation to it.
Vehicle registration?
Yeah, vehicle registration would be one where it applies to everyone that has a vehicle. So it's a general law. It's not like the state is only allowed to pass vehicle registration laws against people that have at least $50,000 cars. It applies to everyone. It only applies to people in Nebraska. People in Virginia don't have to register their cars within the state of Nebraska. It is content independent because it can require us to register our cars every 1 year, every 5 years, every 10 years, whatever it wants. And it's a supreme because unless the state gives you an exception, you don't get to claim one. One of the things that people often point to as an exemption for not doing things is a religious exemption, which is pretty common. But a lot of people don't realize, for the most part, the First Amendment is not what gives people the right to object to a law based on religious observations. There was a case in 1990 that dealt with smoking peyote that has the conclusion that laws of neutral applicability, the First Amendment, you don't get to use it. And the case was some American Indians in, I think, Washington smoked peyote and then were declined for unemployment benefits because they tested positive for drugs. And they said smoking peyote was part of their religious ritual. And the court said smoking peyote they didn't pass it to infringe on religious rights. It has nothing to do with religion. In order to somewhat reverse this, both the federal government and the states, various states have passed Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. So if you say this law prohibits me from doing some aspect of my religious faith, the government has to show this is a compelling government interest and there's no less restrictive way to further advance it. So it's not like people's rights override the government. It's the government's own exception overrides its other rules. So even things like religious freedom are really not a violation of the law of supremacy when it comes to political authority. The last section of Chapter 1 gets into the writer's methodology. He follows something called moral intuitionism, which is a moral theory I do not myself subscribe to, but I think is uniquely valuable for arguments like this where people bring in different moral theories. There's two, maybe three, broad categories, genuses of moral theories with multiple species and then other ones as well. So the two biggest ones are deontological ethics, which refer to duties that people have. The chief one of those is Kantian deontology. Then there is consequentialist ethics, which looks toward the result of your actions to see if something is moral. The chief among that is utilitarianism. There's virtue ethics, and then there's some other much smaller moral theories, of which moral intuitionism is one of them. And the problem with a lot of these arguments is, let's say someone who is a divine command deontologist who believes that right and wrong is determined by what God says is arguing about politics with a utilitarian who wants to maximize happiness and minimize pain. They're not going to be able to argue at the government because they're coming from two totally different value systems. So the argument cannot take place. But moral intuitionism is, and what he tries to use here, is to rather assuming moral theories, he tries to deduce principles from moral claims that are initially relatively uncontroversial, rather than trying to build an entire universe of moral claims and then argue from that. We'll just start with things we all agree upon and see what arguments we can make from there. And this is pretty common in philosophy, you know, the idea of using thought experiments, but he explicitly makes it his methodology in this book.
I think it was a wise choice considering the field he's writing in, because he also states the fact that a lot of people, and honestly myself included before I read this, have no background in political anarchism. And a lot of people either dismiss it or don't give it a second chance or think they understand it without learning about it. So I think by starting in a place where he can find common ground and get people to say, okay, yeah, I agree with that. Yes, this is an argument no one could disagree with. I think he's more likely to write compelling evidence for what he's trying to share.
And an example of this is his parable at the beginning about someone that's going around a village locking people who are vandalizing in the basement. And most people go, well, hold up, you can't do that. And then he says, okay, some police go around and they arrest some kids who are spray painting and breaking windows, and they put them in jail for the night. And most people go, oh, yeah, I think that's fine. And then he goes, okay, so now you have to explain why one person can do it and the other person can't. And then you go, oh, you know, you're right. That person can do it. That person can't. Well, that person's the government. These people aren't the government. That's the difference. And he goes, okay, so you are relying on political authority to explain the difference. Where does that political authority come from? And that's where he's going to go next in the book. And, I mean, his conclusion is that there is no political authority. And later in the book, he will then attempt to describe how society would function without political authority. He is, as mentioned earlier, an anarchist, so that is going to be the basis of his argument, as am I. So I'm not going to be very hostile to what he says, which is why we have the skeptic Lauren here to poke all the holes in his arguments.
I will say I'm very interested in, and I haven't finished the book yet, but I'm very, very interested in how he sees society operating without political authority. Because when I read this, a lot of it really does make sense to me. And it's something without, you know, completely ignoring the premises of his arguments, I don't fundamentally disagree with. But with a lot of political theory, where I have issues is the difference between theory and application. And it bothers me when theories are presented without anything practical for how it would work in society. So the fact that he has a section dedicated to what it would look like, I'm excited to get there. He says is that most people believe that government is incredibly beneficial, that without it, society would collapse into an unbelievable state of chaos, which I would put myself in that camp right now. And then he says, I would ask the reader to set this belief aside for the time being. The question of the first part of this book is not whether government is good or bad. The question is whether the government has certain special rights that you and I do not have, and whether we have certain special duties to the government that we do not have toward anyone else.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to Left, Right, and Unwanted. We'll be back again soon.
Please tune in next time, and thank you for listening.